I am fascinated, intrigued, and honored.
You
by
may
the
have done what they said you did, but
they
you
are magnificent,
they
marvelous.
Say you are.
You
need to know that you're okay just the way you are. You succeeded in you as a child.
What you've been through matters.
This podcast is designed for you.
It's
love on a mission
hope.
In a world
about
where
the human
focus
experience.
Is greatly lacking.
My name is Ginger Wilk, and we're here to talk about that which matters.
Welcome to That Which Matters. I'm so excited today for this episode and the next one that we're going to have because we actually have our very first guest, John Mealy. And I want to tell you a little bit. I'm going to introduce him in a moment. He is a dear, dear friend. He has been somebody that has mentored me professionally, somebody who has brought passion into my life and many other people's lives professionally and as a friend. And he's here today to share about his stories. He always used to tell me, you know, my credentials are not degrees or certificates, but life, L-I-F-E. That's what he used to put on his business card because that's what he speaks about in terms of the wisdom that he's able to share as his experience. And I'll tell you, when I thought about, you know, who should I have as my very first guest, it rang true to me what I've always thought over the years, that wherever I've gone, wherever I've heard speakers, it's never really impressed me whether or not they've had a whole bunch of degrees, whether or not they've written 1,000 books. If you're going to have me sitting somewhere and listening and having tears well up in my eyes or having my heart inspired, it's going to be because somebody is in the trenches. Somebody has been with people. Somebody has been touching lives. Somebody has had boots on the ground. That's who I want to listen to. And so that's why I chose John Mealy as my first guest, because he has had boots on the ground and he has influenced so, so many people. And so we're going to focus on a couple of areas, one being on recovery and then later on mentorship. And so I just want to thank you, John, for being here today. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being my very first guest.
Well, thank you, Ginger. I would like to meet that man that you were just talking about. But I am very grateful to be here. And it's just wonderful to be half of what Ginger's talked about. And I guess I could say I worked awfully hard at becoming the man that God intended me to be. I didn't know that for a long time. I got into recovery when I was 45 years old. So I had a lot of anguish, a lot of, as I described myself before recovery came into my life and the things that come with it, I was a pretty much of a wretched human being due to the effects of alcoholism and drug addiction. Thank God I hit a bottom and I was able to ask something greater than me for help. And believe me, at the beginning of my journey of recovery, which really was my beginning of living life the way it should be, I was absolutely lost. I didn't have a clue. I didn't know from up or down. And I was very much afraid. Thank God all those things got me to go to any lengths to understand what living life on life's terms, what it was really about. And I have to say that what I did primarily at the beginning for a few years was honestly was just showing up. And something that I wasn't sure about yet, that connection with God, a higher power, something greater than me, put some wonderful people in my life to show me the way. And that really made quite a difference for me. They just happened to be men and some women, but mostly men that showed me a different way to live, not because they talked to me about it, but because I was able to witness the way they lived. And I very much wanted to be that type of person. In my past, I always thought about being something better than I was, and I just didn't know how to go about it. The denial of substance abuse is real. It's a terrible place to be, where you really believe that what isn't real. The denial of substance abuse use puts you in a place that there is no way to get better because you don't think what you're doing and how you're living is wrong. So the very first step in recovery is acknowledging that I have a problem, that I cannot drink safely. It's a long journey. Thank God it's still going, but at the beginning it was, I just showed up, shut my mouth. It was the first time in my entire life at the age of 45 that I actually listened to someone other than myself. And I think that was the key. So the things in recovery that I learned and keep on learning are really, it's about age-old principles. Really, to put it simply, just to be a good neighbor, to be a kind person, to be tolerant, patient, loving, caring, understanding, with compassion, and most importantly, empathy, and to accept the outcome of practicing those principles. And, you know, for me to say that today, it sounds easy, it sounds okay, here I am, I did that, but my goodness, I can't even imagine how I could explain the difficulty. My last drink was 1995, so it's been quite a while, but believe me, at the beginning, it was the most difficult, hardest thing I ever attempted in my life. And sometimes it still is. And I'm not just talking about staying away from a drink. I'm talking about living life on life's terms. And I am a member of a 12-step program. I'm certainly not here to be an advertisement for that, but that's where I chose to go to get help. And that program, that 12-step program, you know, my God, which I didn't know at the time, brought me there, but then eventually the program brought me back to God. And today I base most of my life, probably all of my life, I try to do God's will in all of my endeavors, bullet points. Mm-hmm. I've learned through this process that change is absolutely necessary. If I'm the same person that I was when I drank, I'm going to drink again. So it means to look at oneself, to acknowledge that there's things that need to be changed and make better, and to work on it with the help of other people. At the beginning, it was all about that, and eventually through the process, I was able to rely on something greater than me. So I had difficulty with that God thing, and I've come to understand very simply, as long as I believe in something greater than me and it's not me, I'm going to have a journey where it will become personal. My belief and my choice of God will be personal to me. So my God isn't Ginger's God, and Ginger's God isn't mine. But really, in the bottom line, I believe that our God is exactly that, ours for everyone. Service to another human being is paramount. And I believe in my heart that that's the reason we're here, to be of service to God and to others. And I've tried to the best of my ability to live that way. And of course, that brought me to a wonderful part of my life that is still going on, but it is a mentoring of other people, of young men. Through the 12-step program, I have realized that I could help other people just from my experience, strength, and hope.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, because 45 years is a really, really long time, right, to be struggling, you know, with addiction or with substance use issue. I know a lot of people would wonder, because every one of us has been touched by people that struggle in that area, right? We all have an association with people who struggle in that area. And I guess a lot of people would wonder, what was it about that time, that season, that made you ready to be able to embrace change?
Well, I hit bottom. Mm-hmm. And so why does everyone that needs to step into recovery have to hit bottom? My personal belief is that my biggest problem then and today at times still is, and it's what we all have, and it's ego and pride. And yeah, that denial that I mentioned, it's all based on ego and pride. I'm okay. I could take care of it. I got this. The great I was me. Mm. And the denial was based on really self-centered fear. If I had to admit that I couldn't do this on my own and I couldn't live right, then I would have to admit there was something wrong with me and I was sick. My ego would not allow that.
Right.
And the thing that got me into recovery was exactly that choice of, I was so bottomed out. I was on the verge of losing everything. And I had this idea, and this is what I talk about, my crazy ego. Because I had the idea, I thought it was a good idea, and my idea was, because I attempted to not drink and drug on a regular daily basis for a long time, and I failed every time. So I said, I can't do this, but the great eye has an idea. I know how to stop. I'll just commit suicide.
Wow.
And I attempted to do that. Thank God that that didn't work. And I ended up in a lockdown in a St. Rayfield's hospital. And that started my journey.
Wow.
So, you know, denial, because I'm too headstrong, because I'm so proud of who I am, even when I'm under a bridge. So think about how crazy that is. I'm under a bridge, but you tell me you could help me, and I'm, no, I got this. Mm-hmm. So that's a sickness, it's a mental disorder.
Yeah.
Really and truly.
Yeah.
So thank God today there's help, there's a solution, there's a wonderful way out. And I've met some incredible men and women, and in the program of this 12-step program, that just I'm in awe of. And it's really from the grace of God.
So what do you think are some of the major triggers for people when they're struggling with addiction?
So I go to schools. I've been doing it for 23 years, and I bring information about substance abuse. Mm-hmm. And I've learned so much from the kids in school. And I've been given a gift from the beginning for this part of my life. I remember, I identify with exactly what these kids are saying. And what it is, the number one reason, is they don't feel accepted. They don't feel a part of. They don't feel like they're okay. Did they get a different book than me? How do they know how to figure this thing out? It turns out that it's all about fear. It's all about self-worth. I'm 10, 12 years old. How can I have any self-worth? I don't even know what it means.
Yeah.
And I find out that doing good things, being okay with some things you participate in, it builds some self-worth. And the fear of connecting with my classmates is so overwhelming. I disconnect. And I make up all these things. He's no good. He doesn't care. He's an idiot. All to protect myself from being vulnerable and asking to be a part of. And that's the number one reason I've discovered over the years. I've listened and talked to thousands of young people. I even started this in one school up in Westbrook, Connecticut. I started this part of club, where it got adopted to be a part of the curriculum. When we started it with me and a couple counselors, we discovered that some students in a high school, they were eating their lunch period in a bathroom by themselves, some in a closet by themselves, because they were so afraid to be rejected from trying to be a part of.
Oh my goodness.
So that result of feeling not a part of is so scary. And then you're introduced to, let's get together, four or five of us, and after one or two beers at 14, those four people become my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
They love me. They think I'm okay. They think I'm cool. Everything is okay. So I continue. And there's no consequences when I'm 14. I don't lose a house. I don't lose a wife. I don't lose a job. But this disease of substance abuse is very progressive. It's a physical allergy and a mental obsession, which results in a mental disorder. And there's a genetic piece. So there's real history of there's a reason to deal with this as a disease and a mental illness. And
Yeah, that loneliness, just, you know,
absolutely.
And there's been a couple of episodes where we've touched on loneliness and rejection, and especially with young people, but it's amazing to hear how that loneliness permeates so early in this age bracket of, you know, junior high or elementary school even, and begins to take root with this self-hatred or whatever. It just seems to me that over the years there should be more work there's anti-bullying things that are in place that were never in place years ago, but just to help kids to be able to socialize with one another.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I try to bring that message to schools. There's some, I was doing a group of 7th and 8th grade boys, small groups, and just talking about choices and what we could do for each other. What can we do to help each other? And you know, this is about a we thing.
Yeah.
You know, I end up alone, we do things together. It's that whole concept of, you know, a village brings up a child. It's all about that. Things that when we're drinking or drugging, we isolate. That's the number one offender of alcohol and drug abuse. We isolate. We're self-centered. We don't feel the things that are so important, which when I was 15, 20, 25, I thought they were corny, feeling, you know, happy, tolerant, grateful, being of service to another human being, being selfless instead of selfish, didn't compute.
Yeah.
It was just like, what does that mean? Never mind, what does it mean? How do I put that in action? Well, I didn't learn that until I was 45, and it's such a much better way.
Yeah.
It absolutely is.
What would you say to family members that have, you know, relatives, spouses, children that struggle with this area?
Well, it is so, you know, there's still a social stigma and shame around this.
Yeah.
So sometimes I say to the kids in the schools, you know, you're afraid maybe to go to a parent to talk about you're having trouble with life and you find that you're drinking too much. You don't want to go and talk to your parent because right away you feel they're going to judge you, they're going to kick you to the curbside, and your number one thing as a 14-year-old, your goal is to have your mother and father or people in charge of you, your close people, to be proud of you.
Yeah.
So how can I go to them and say, Ma, I'm not doing okay, I'm drinking too much, I need help? That's not easy.
Yeah.
If you would just understand that. Think about it this way. You went to a doctor. Nobody knew you went there. You told your doctor you have a bad back. They checked everything out, and the doctor said, I'm sorry to tell you, but you have cancer, and we need to do treatment. You would run home fast as you could be, as you could. Go to your home. Hold your mother and father. Say, Ma, Dad, I got cancer. I need help. And they would help you beyond. They love you like you can't imagine. So why can't we do that when we're drinking too much?
Right, right. There is such a stigma.
Absolutely.
And a lack of education among,
absolutely,
you know, the people who, I know that there's, you know, there's Al-Anon and places,
absolutely,
like that they can go to.
Alateen.
Alateen, yeah, for sure. And I just think that there's just not enough people that are really reaching out and getting help. I think there is a lot of shame. I know that we've seen that with some of the working with the parents that have children that are in prison, you know,
sure,
that are teenagers. There's shame around that.
Absolutely.
And but yet the parents need support and
right,
they need education and understanding.
Right.
And so with this, all the more. But that's a really good suggestion in terms of, like, so what would you say to them if, let's just say, they say, there's no way I can tell my parents that, you know, I'm drinking too much. What would be your next suggestion for
my
them?
Next suggestion is very simple. You sit down with a couple people that in your life, that family or friends, relatives, and you talk with them in a group, and you get some information to say, this is the trouble I'm having, but, like, the message you're hearing today, here today, mm-hmm, is about a solution. So, you know, why avoid that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, why wait till a wake or a funeral?
Yeah.
You know, I've had communities where there was an overdose and a death on say, Smith Street.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of York and Charles and Jewel Street, come together as a community and say, let's support each other. We lost a community member. They close their blinds and they're, oh my God, stay away. Look at, he died, she died. Mm. Instead of coming together and say, let's do something to not have this happen again.
Yeah.
It's that shame. It's that, you know, I want to tell you something really interesting. There was a survey done, a study with parents, and they asked 1,000 parents, 500 parents, which was 1,000 people, do you think your child drinks or has tried or whatever? 95% of them denied any of it at all. Then they asked the children of these 500 parents, 80%, yes, I tried it. Yes, I have a problem, 40%. 30% was daily. So it came to a conclusion. The parents said, 95% said, my kid never even tried it because it's simple. Mm. If they admit it, they think that means they're a failure as a parent.
Yeah.
So it goes back to the ego and the pride.
And the pride once again.
Yeah. So they're turning their back. My kids are fine. Don't be ridiculous. But in the meantime, the kids are telling us there's 70% that do it on a regular basis. So those are the things we have to change. And believe me, from 20 years ago, it's much better.
That's good.
You know, and I'm glad you mentioned Al-Anon and Alateen, because there's 12-step programs that help the people that aren't of need of recovery, but an emotional side of what this disease brings. This disease disrupts so many lives and families and communities. And we're in an epidemic now. We
yeah.
are truly in an epidemic.
And it's hard because, you know, there's a lot of hopelessness around this whole issue because, you know, you hear stories of people, they've tried everything for their kid or for themselves, and they've gone to multiple, you know, long-term facilities, or they can't afford the facilities or whatever. And so, you know, But again, that's highlighting the negative or the things that aren't working. And I think that's part of the problem is that we don't hear enough of the stories of people who have, you know, 20 years under their belt and all of the good work that they're doing and how their lives have been turned around. I think that's a problem is we're severely lacking in hearing about a lot of that.
Right. And for some reason, we tend to talk about the negative.
Yeah.
Like sometimes at a meeting, I'll hear when I, you know, the first few years I was in, and I would hear an old timer, as we say, I guess now I'm an old timer, but they would say, look to your right, look to your left, those people won't be here in a week. And I would get so angry because I would respond to that by saying, look around this room. I know A, B, C, D, and E, they've been here 10, 12, 15, 20. You know, that's what I look at, not the people, because not everyone succeeds.
Right.
But I'm involved with a bunch of good men that I do rover meetings and I do retreats with, and they're all between 20 and 45 years of sobriety. You know, my sponsor just passed from an illness, died sober. He had 43 years of sobriety.
Wow.
I mean, there is a lot of success. And we have to get that out there because it is so much better to live that way instead of in the darkness of substance abuse, because it's a terrible place to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you end up thinking suicide is a good answer to get away.
No.
And that's ridiculous.
So you personally never went into any like residential treatment or
no? I went into an inpatient at St. Rayfield's, a lockdown because of the suicide attempt.
Yes.
And then I went 12 weeks to an outpatient program, and then I've done tons of things in the 12-step recovery program for a long time, and it's a wonderful fellowship. It's a worldwide, international, life-saving thing.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful, and it's absolutely in my heart and soul, I believe it was God-given.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of principles from what I know, godly principles, biblical principles, like making
age-old
amends,
principle.
Right? You know, making amends. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed in some of the groups that I've run through the years is that people in recovery tend to be the stars in the groups because they've already gone through a process of, you know, taking inventory and, yep. you know, making amends. And so in any type of group, it could be focused on anything. They're stars. Like they have such great experience because they've really taken that, you know, kind of look at themselves, that inventory of who they are and where they've been. And, it mobilizes and engages the other members of the group, even if it's not about recovery.
Yep.
So,
yep. So in the 12 steps, the first step mentions the substance. 2 through 12 is all about the finding yourself from within.
Yeah.
And it's all about principle. So step 2 is hope. Step 3 is faith. Step 4, and I'll give this one example. The principle is courage. And why is that? Because step 4 is the personal inventory. You need courage to do that honestly and open. To look at yourself and to acknowledge it in step 5 to another human being. So you're saying, hey, look at all my scabs. Help me change that.
Yeah.
So, of course, the principle of courage, it's very relevant to me.
Right.
You know, like hope and faith in 2 and 3 is relevant because you need hope to meet something greater than you and faith to turn your will and life over to that something greater than you to make choices to live a life. So God's will for me today is not to drink. If I choose not to drink, which is a gift from God, the choice, his love and power will help me succeed in not drinking today. So it's not sitting and magically not drinking. It's taking the action. This program is built around love, kindness, tolerance. But God's grace is an undeserved gift. That's what grace is defined as. And your part in is showing up and taking the action that the grace that he's given you.
Yeah.
And really the most important part is to give it back, not only in just in the 12-step recovery program, but in our community. It starts with our family.
Yes.
It washes over into our community. And the feelings of being a part of and accepted and being a part of the solution is I smile.
Yeah.
My heart is filled. And I never knew that for the first 45 years.
Would you have ever thought back then, you know,
never,
that you would be doing the work that you're doing today,
never,
impacting lives?
It took a few years to even realize that it was possible in recovery.
Yeah.
I just was there not to pick up a drink and a drug.
Yeah.
Because I was, it was terrible.
Well, I know that many, many lives have been impacted through yours. And thank you so much for sharing this story. We're going to come back and have another episode and talk a little bit more about it in the area of mentoring. So thank you so much for being a part of this episode.
Thank you, Ginger. I'm truly grateful to be here.
In collaboration with IML Productions, this has been your host, Ginger Wilk, with That Which Matters. Thank you for listening.